The deteriorating situation in Iraq has the international community scrambling for some way to avoid all-out sectarian warfare. And it also has experts in international law wondering if there is a viable model for nation building when a superpower with the resources of the United States ever confronts a rogue nation like Iraq, as the U.S. did back in 2003. Noah Feldman, professor at Harvard Law School, served as the senior constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq when he was just 33 years old. He helped to draft Iraq's interim constitution. The constitution provided for the election of a national assembly, included a Bill of Rights, and outlined a separation between religion and state. At the time, Feldman and the Bush administration were criticized for excluding Arab, Iraqi, and/or Muslim legal scholars from the process. But today's chaos, Feldman says, comes directly from not seeing how distinct the missions of military security and nation building really are.
The crucial lesson that I think we didn't know, but should have known, is that you can't both construct a new state when the state has failed and also make a democracy work at the exact same time. Those need to be two different steps. First, the state has to be constructed. The garbage has to be picked up. People have to know that they're safe in their homes and that they're not killing each other. And then you can begin the process of negotiation to make a democracy work. What happened in Iraq is that the state collapsed, and we said, well, we'll help build the state and let's make a democracy at exactly the same moment. And instead of getting a resolution, we got a civil war. And it's pretty hard to negotiate a constitution during a civil war.
So speaking as a historian and as a legal scholar, the United States really approached Iraq with extraordinary naivete, given the successes in the Marshall Plan in Europe in World War II and what happened in Japan, in that these were pretty recent lessons. What constrained the United States from taking a firmer hand in Iraq than it certainly took a firm hand in Europe and Japan in post-World War II?
There were two elements. One was practical and one was theoretical. And the practical one was that in the run-up to the war, as everybody knows now, there was a great dispute roughly between Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Colin Powell about how many troops the United States needed to take out Saddam. And Rumsfeld won that debate, and the United States invaded and took out Saddam with a relatively small number of troops, fewer than 100,000 troops. The problem was you couldn't actually control the country with that small number of troops. And so practically, very quickly, as the Iraqis began to realize that we did not have the troops sufficient to control the country, violence began to spread and insecurity began to spread, and that led to civil war. And that was the first source of this problem, of thinking that we could actually manage a country with the same number of troops that it took to conquer the country. Those are two different things. The second theoretical component was that we were deeply committed to the idea that we were not an imperial occupier, not a colonial occupier, and therefore we should confer democracy as quickly as possible on the Iraqis. And in theory, that was a great idea, but in reality, democracy wasn't going to function as long as people were killing each other in the streets. And so that second problem deepened the first practical problem.
Although we said exactly the same thing after World War II, that we didn't want to be an imperial power in Germany and we didn't want to be an imperial power in Japan.
And we said it, but we didn't do it.
Right, exactly. We said it, but we didn't do it. You know, it's interesting to think back now that Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld had a massively different view of what the objective was in Iraq. The difference between toppling Saddam and reconstructing Iraq couldn't be more different. And I suspect that's your view today.
You know, back in the time of World War II, we were more in touch with the idea of what you might politely call diplomatic hypocrisy. We insisted that we weren't the imperial power in Asia, but we were. Ditto in Germany. Nowadays, again, it's very ironic, we were more sincere in our belief that we wanted to confer democracy. And I think that sincerity was connected to the naivete of which you spoke. In terms of what the perspectives were of the different actors within the government, I think that remains a very complex question. I think Secretary Rumsfeld actually mostly wanted to show that you could win a war with a light military force. I don't think he was very much interested in the reconstruction. And I think Secretary Powell wanted to show, based on the traditional Powell doctrine, that you could only win a war with a very large force. And I don't think he was that focused on the reconstruction either. Among those who wanted reconstruction, there were neoconservatives like Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, who were committed to the idea that a democracy could emerge. And they had an attractive part of their view, namely they weren't racists. They didn't believe that Arabs couldn't have democracy. But they also had a naive part of their view, namely they didn't think through that you can't have democracy without stability first.
You know, just to explore the ironies even further, you know, today the Germans, I mean, you know, mostly thank the U.S. for its hypocrisy in World War II. The Japanese, I think, are gratified by the success of what's happened since World War II. And even the Vietnamese, to a certain extent, are friends with the United States. Iraq, you know, is just filled with contempt for the United States. What do you think is your realistic hope for the future of Iraq right now?
Well, as you say, nothing succeeds like success. If you temporarily suspend people's democracy, but then they get democracy and relative wealth, then they're happy. In Iraq, the negative feeling is directly connected to our abject failure. Nobody would have liked us as an occupier, but they like us less as a failed occupier and as a failed state builder. And so, again, in retrospect, the first lesson is don't think you can make a whole country into a new country if wars are being fought at the same time. And second, don't think that you have to be liked all the time. Being liked is secondary when it comes to matters of statecraft that are this significant. And I think if you see Iraq's ongoing struggle to incorporate all of the different groups in the country into a functioning government, we also contributed to that failure because under circumstances of civil war, no one trusts anybody else. And even today, the Sunnis in Iraq don't believe that the Shia government will fully deal them in and give them a fair shake. And that is what stands in the way of their going over to the side of the government and fighting against ISIS or the other al-Qaeda affiliates in the country.
Yeah, and they're probably right in that as well, although, you know, there are many, many players and it is a very complex question. Now, before we go, thinking way forward in the 21st century, we talk so much about nation building. Do you see anywhere on the globe where it's conceivable that it will actually take place effectively, that there will be, you know, when we look back on the 21st century, an effective model for nation building and the creation of real democracy?
Only in places where it's possible to separate out the construction of a functioning state from the building of democratic institutions. One country which has been doing this on its own rather remarkably is Tunisia. Tunisia is a small country, but it's where the Arab Spring began. And there, the Tunisians themselves have negotiated power sharing and a new constitution which they've ratified. And they've done it all without an occupying army. And they've managed to maintain consensus among their political leadership despite some very deep ideological divisions. And that's a very impressive model. And I would say I'm very guardedly optimistic about it.
Noah Feldman is professor at Harvard Law School. He served as the senior constitutional advisor to the Coalition Provision Authority in Iraq. He spoke to us from our partner, WGBH, in Boston. Professor Feldman, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.